Little interest demonstrated last week for a Senate hearing on civil service reform and little movement toward any legislation. Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee Chairman James Lankford says his subcommittee's in listening stage right now. Bob Tobias is a professor at the Key Executive Leadership Program at American University and looking at the results of this subcommittee hearing, or lack thereof, I guess, Bob, if only one other senator besides Senator Lankford bothered to show up. And not much attention focused on it. It's kind of if a tree falls in a Senate hearing, does anybody hear it?
Obviously not, Francis. there is much consensus that various provisions in the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978 should be addressed. But in order to have something get enacted legislatively, you almost need the concurrence of the unions, the administration, and members of Congress. And right now, that doesn't exist. And further, the members of Congress who were really knowledgeable about federal employee issues are no longer there. So even though there's a need, the coalition necessary to create it currently doesn't exist.
Bob, you cite a couple of examples of when reforming has worked in the history of the government. You cite the Federal Comparability Act of 1990, reinventing government, commission to restructure the Internal Revenue Service. What were some of the elements of those that made them work?
Well, I think the one that's probably most analogous to the issue we're discussing today is the Commission to Restructure the IRS, because Congress tacked on some legislation that said that commission would be created and said that the president would appoint people, that the Senate Majority and Minority Leader would appoint people, the Speaker of the House and the Minority Leader of the House would all appoint people to a commission who required to make recommendations on reform of the IRS. So because Congress passed the legislation, because Congress mandated the creation, there were two senators and two members of the House who participated in the deliberations and signed on to the recommendations, which ultimately led to their enactment. So the combination of stakeholders plus an invested group from Congress led to the enactment of the legislation. And I think that's the approach that might be explored and I think should be taken.
The Military Compensation and Retirement Modernization Commission followed a similar approach, not exactly the same, but there were no sitting members of Congress among the 15 members of that commission. But they kind of approached it from the same way, and they made a point of describing before, during, and after they did their work that they went and talked to everybody. They talked to all of the stakeholders, from the rank-and-file members, uniformed members of the military, all the way up to the JCS and all over the place. It strikes me that that's maybe the most critical element of how any potential reforms would work, is that everybody that has any skin at all in the game, no matter how little, should have a voice in at least how the whatever you call it, commission or committee or panel or whatever, moves forward. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Everybody has to have a voice, and that voice has to be represented in whatever recommendations are finally made by the committee. But I think in this case, because members of Congress really are not knowledgeable about civil service and are not really knowledgeable about the laws. They're knowledgeable when they about reacting, as they did in the VA, to saying, well, we ought to be able to fire people more quickly. But that's not a very sophisticated nor knowledgeable approach to recruitment and retention and pay and all of the other things that are really at issue if civil service reform is to be considered. So educating them, educating members of the congressional staff, more than is more important than just asking them what they think. I mean, truly educating people, which a good commission can do, I think is critically important.
I have a pet peeve on that subject, and I think, and I'll explain it, and you can tell me if you think I'm wrong. If you do, I'm open to hearing it. A couple of the groups that represent federal employees or advocate for them on the Hill have asked on a number of occasions to get figures of exactly how many federal employees live in each member's districts, because they say that's the first question they get was, I don't have any idea how many federal employees I have for constituents. OPM has not either been able or willing to provide those numbers. I don't know which, and I don't want to cast aspersions on OPM if it's something that's not doable. But it strikes me that it should be doable in 2015. There should be a way to be able to match information, cross-match it with congressional districts, and at the same time protect the privacy of those people by just giving out numbers. This many people live in Maryland 8 or whatever. And it strikes me that there are some members of Congress who might find big surprises in the number of feds that live in their districts, Bob, and it seems to me that might be the first step toward renewing the coalition that we used to have in the D.C. area that was half Republican and half Democrat, and you had people on both sides of the aisle who could go to their colleagues in each caucus and communicate with them about the importance of federal service in a trusted way. We don't have that anymore.
Well, I think knowledge like that would be very important. Because you don't know. I mean, members of Congress don't know. They have a guess. If they have a large military base, they know they have a large military base that houses so many people. But the federal government is virtually in every county in the United States. And having that information, I think, would be an important piece of information.
The only way I know to make it happen, I suppose, at this point, is for a member of Congress to ask for a GAO, ask the GAO to do an audit and work with OPM and the agencies and whoever else has to be involved for them to collect that information. Because I know for a fact one of the organizations that's tried to find the information is the National Active and Retired Federal Employees, and they just have not been able to do it. Federally Employed Women put out a set of stats that was based on Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers, but that was all based on where the employees worked and not where they lived. And in areas like this area, where you have a lot of folks that say live in Chris Van Hollen's district or Jerry Connolly's district or Barbara Comstock's district and commute into the city, the numbers might not be representative at all and might make a big difference as to how one member of Congress or another relates to his constituents.
Especially since the standard metropolitan area stretches to West Virginia.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of people who commute into this city who live far away, and their member of Congress may not know.
And you can name any number of large cities, the New York area, Chicago area, I'm thinking of Kansas City, St. Louis, any number of large cities where you have big numbers of federal employees that are moving across state lines, let alone within district to district, that might skew those numbers. I've pushed this idea of establishing a civilian compensation retirement modernization commission, Bob, that's modeled on the military one. Is that a workable model, do you think, if one of the tenets is we're going to go and talk to every single stakeholder and incorporate their ideas and concepts into the final recommendations?
I think it is. I think it is. There's, of course, a reluctance, as the union leader said, of opening this can of worms or this issue in the context of a Congress that has been not very friendly toward federal employees. So there's high risk. So there has to be some kind of assurance about what the scope of this commission is going to be before I think there'll be acceptance of all the stakeholders of this kind of an effort.
A couple of the other ones that we've talked about, you've discussed the commission to restructure the IRS, the reinventing government effort during the Clinton administration had some success, but there are some folks that believe that it might have created the trough that we saw of federal employees that we're now seeing manifesting itself by the lack of a kind of a backup generation to the baby boomers as they start to retire. And I wonder what HR lessons we might take away from or try to apply to whatever kind of reform effort comes next, Bob.
Well, I think that certainly everybody who's written about the reinventing government talks about the indiscriminate reduction of federal employees. I think the number was 10,000. And so it was announced that we're going to be more efficient, we're going to be more effective, and we're going to have 10,000 fewer jobs. That's what the Clinton administration said. And then picked HR as the place to effectuate those reductions. And it was ham-handed. It was ill-advised, and we're paying the price now.